first of our lecture series for the semester. We're pleased to have Berkman Fellow Ethan Zuckerman and Eric Asiakwan giving a talk today around innovation in sub-Saharan Africa and information technology. Ethan will probably be able to give a better overall introduction for the topic. And we usually do two things before we get started. One is that if you're joining us here for the first time, we webcast and record all our luncheons, so all your comments and things will be recorded and put on the internet, just so you're aware. And the second of which is that we usually go around introducing ourselves so that we can get to know who's in the room. And then Ethan and Eric will start after that. So my name is Amar Asher, and I'm a Berkman Center staff member.
I'm Steve Klosterman. I'm an alumni of MIT. I was recommended to attend this series by a friend of mine who's interested in technology.
I'm Aaron Shaw. I'm a fellow at Berkman. I'm a PhD student in sociology at UC Berkeley. My name is Peter Chang. I'm a second year
student. Hello, here.
I'm Chatterjee.
Be loud, people. Not only do we have to hear you up here, but they have to hear you in Africa as well. So we have to scream in. And it's really pushing the bits that far. It takes a lot of effort. So.
My name is Adam Holland. I'm a research assistant here with the Graduate Project.
I'm Jess Mitchell. I'm a former geek. These two will explain that. I used to work with both of them. And presently the project manager for the Fluid Project.
I'm Dan Jones. I am the new digital media producer starting my first day here.
Good.
Rob Farris, I'm the research director here at the center. Very Fisher, I'm the faculty director at the center.
Jeannie Austin, I'm a candidate for a master's degree in global health law at Georgetown and a visiting researcher.
My name is Sam Onyemi-Lukwe. I'm an entrepreneur. I do trainings all over the continent of Africa as well as executive search work.
Jill York, Berkman staff.
Erica George, Berkman staff.
David Pearson, cultural technologist from Climate Education.
I'm Harry Lewis. I'm a computer science professor at Harvard and a faculty fellow at the center.
Doug Searles, I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center.
My name is Mariana Simone. I'm a software developer.
Jean Koo, Berkman Fellow.
Becca Tabaski, Berkman Center staff.
Oliver Goodenough, a professor at Vermont Law School and fellow here.
Persephone Miel, fellow at the Center with the Media Republic Project.
Melanie Dulon, fellow at the Berkman Center with Copyright for Librarians Project.
Sandy Singer, I'm a local lawyer.
Yeah, Sue and I work on a digital natives project here.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm Ethan Zuckerman. I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center.
I'm Eric Osiakwan. I'm an internet entrepreneur from Ghana.
And Eric and I have been working together in one fashion or another for a large number of years at this point. We've been lucky enough, one of the things that's I think part of the success of the Berkman Center is that we have sort of circles of orbit around the center and people who work here day to day, including including folks like Jill, who are having a lot of fun with playing audio in the background. There are people who are based at Berkman every day. There's a set of fellows who, some of whom are local, some of whom are around the world. There's also something that we've talked about in the past called Berkman affiliates, people who do a lot of work with Berkman and who we sort of anxiously look forward to their visit. And Eric and I now have sort of an annual tradition of getting together and doing a talk as part of this lunch series to take a look at some of the developments around IT innovation on the African continent. If you can roll back sort of 5 years to when we sort of started doing these conversations had almost everything to do with infrastructure. Where are the cables going? Where are the electric cables going? I wish I could tell you that those problems are not still the problems we have to concentrate on, and we're certainly going to be talking about those. But we're also trying to broaden the interpretive framework a little bit and talk a little bit more about the culture of innovation. So I want to see if I can frame these remarks a little bit, and I'm going to do it, I think, mostly by making fun of my younger self, which is almost as much fun of making fun of myself now, but it's often easier if I reach back a little bit. Shortly before I came to the Berkman Center, I was involved with founding a nonprofit organization that had its headquarters out in western Massachusetts, out in North Adams, Massachusetts, and also in Accra, Ghana. It was that standard Western Mass, West Africa commute that everyone's doing nowadays. It's a very easy form of telecommute that a lot of people are involved with. But I was one of the co-founders of a group called Geek Corps, which was trying very hard to take some of the ideas of the Peace Corps, the idea that you could take folks who have will and skill and talent and time from developed nations, encourage them to come into developing nations, and try to do skills transfer. And what we wanted to do was skills transfer very specifically around the ICT field. In 1999, when we started doing this work, we had just sort of hit the first peak of the US internet bubble. People were extremely excited about it. Companies were selling for billions of dollars. It seemed almost possible that you could imagine an African company sort of climbing to these great heights within the ICT space. We were a little premature. In fact, Eric's going to talk about a company that has climbed to these heights in the African ICT space, but in a very different way than we were looking at. We tried to do something with Geek Corps very much based around the success of a business that I'd also been involved with, which was sort of one of the first Web 2.0 businesses well before anyone was talking about Web 2.0, this whole notion of a participatory web where you actually ask the users to do the heavy lifting for you. Also far out in western Massachusetts, we had started a company called Tripod. We invited 15 million users to come in, build their own web pages, and in the course of building this both ludicrously successful and ludicrously unsuccessful business, and let me unpack that for a second, successful in the sense that we got millions of people to use it, and people ultimately gave us many, many millions of dollars for the rights to the software, unsuccessful in the sense that we never actually made any money, never turned a profit, never had a balance sheet that was anything other than absolutely horrifying, we discovered that running a business in one fashion or another in the ICT space requires a set of interlocking skills. If you want to start a company, and this is true now in the Web 2.0 space as much as in the Web 1.0 space, you need programmers. You need system administrators, people who can actually keep your servers up and running. And this is true even in the cloud computing age. You can't farm it entirely out to Amazon. Trust me, when it goes down, everyone knows. If you watched Twitter a couple of weeks ago and suddenly no one had any icons anymore, that's when you miss your sysadmins. You need designers. You need people who are going to construct content, because even if you're asking your users to create all the content for you, you have to tell them what to do. People actually have to write that. You need salespeople. You need marketing people. You need management that can run this. These are all discrete skill sets. And if you have a lot of these skill sets at your disposal, you're in a much better position to build a new venture than if you have to acquire them all yourself. Anyone who's ever tried to run a business on their own and has had to become a programmer, a designer, a manager, a fundraiser, an ad salesperson understands just how difficult that is. So the theory behind Geek Corps was we were going to find ways to bring people who had these skills into countries like West Africa. They were going to donate their time for 2, 4, 6 months, in the cases of some, well over a year. And we were going to try to train enough of a local cadre that you would have the chance for new businesses to sort of emerge from those communities. We came up with this theory largely based around sitting around North Adams and sort of thinking, what could we do that would be helpful? Had we actually bothered to read the academic literature, we probably would have realized that this was more or less the idea put forth by Professor Annalise Saxanian out of the University of California at Berkeley, who wrote a hugely influential and very, very useful book called Regional Advantage. And Regional Advantage is basically an analysis of what worked really well for Silicon Valley early on in the sort of flush of venture capital in the early PC movement, and what didn't work so well around here, particularly in the technology companies around Route 128. And Saxanian basically comes up with a theory where she argues that Silicon Valley was particularly receptive to startup businesses because it was based on sort of a network model. Engineers went pretty fluidly from one firm to another. People had friends at other firms. It was not considered a betrayal of your comrades if you went over to a different firm. It was actually considered kind of a cool thing to have this network of people at a bunch of different firms. She contrasts that to the business culture around companies like Digital, which she describes as autarkic, which is such a wonderful word that people should say it as often as possible. But in autarkic companies or economies, the attempt is to build everything in-house. So you look at a company like Digital, and at least at one point of its organization, it was doing everything from building power supplies to building software and everything in between. There weren't a whole lot of outside partners providing technology, and so you didn't have this sort of networked economy. And so the theory was, when you wanted to roll out of something like Digital and start a startup, you didn't know who to call. Whereas when you rolled out of Hewlett-Packard, you had lots of friends who were with lots of other firms, you knew about partnership, you knew how to build things this way. It seemed like a much better way to build businesses. So it's an interesting set of theories. I think that we didn't do especially well with it at Geekcore. I think in part because we chose an extremely expensive model. We would take Americans with too much free time, raise your hand, Jess, and ship them over for months and months at a time and try to make it possible for them, you know, not to die and not to starve and so on and so forth. And that turns out to be surprisingly expensive to support people in other countries. But it turns out to be extremely difficult to build up enough of that skill set locally in a country like Ghana, where Jess was working, where Eric and I, well, Eric has spent a lot more time than I have, but I've spent a lot of time as well. In part because you're working in such a skills vacuum that when you train someone to be a very talented system administrator, they are suddenly one of the most in-demand people in the country. And one of the phenomena that the three of us have all seen at this point are people who end up having a much higher level of technical skill than their peers suddenly becoming shockingly in demand and working 80, 100, 110 hours a week on all sorts of different projects until they explode and melt down in one fashion or another. And this is a very common problem in West Africa and to lesser extents in Southern and in Eastern Africa. So I want to talk about a slightly different model that I'm seeing emerge, and then I think Eric is going to talk about a couple of other models that he's seeing emerge. And I want us to sort of go back a little bit in time to Kenya earlier this year, late last year. I assume everyone's more or less familiar with the events. There was both a parliamentary and presidential election took place on December 27th in Kenya. Quite a surprising election. The opposition won parliament pretty decisively. A lot of people who'd been in power for a very, very long time were chased out of their seats. A real transformation of power. Oddly enough, despite the fact that the opposition soundly took parliament, they surprisingly lost the presidency by 300,000 votes, which wasn't determined until 3 days after the rest of the election results were in. And oddly enough, the president decided to swear himself in again within an hour of that announcement, while the Federal Election Commission was still saying, we're not really sure these are correct results. This was a very typical stolen election scenario, a very, very close election. Widespread allegations of fraud on both sides, an attempt to essentially return to normalcy very, very quickly so that you didn't actually have a transition of power. What went wrong very, very quickly and in very worrying fashion was you started seeing ethnic violence erupting, and really just in two parts of a very, very large country, but in certain very poor inner city neighborhoods in Nairobi, and particularly in the Rift Valley, where you have some very long-standing ethnic and land distribution tensions. But it was a really ugly moment. You have a country that is, in many ways, one of the best hopes for the African continent, enormously economically productive, considered one of the most stable places on the continent, descending into ethnic violence very, very quickly. The good news on all of this is that Kenya pulled out, and pulled out fast. And by late March, you have a joint government. There's a lot of complaints about the joint government. Largely the way the joint government worked it out was by throwing lots of really lucrative ministerships to both sides and having power sharing between a president and a prime minister. But it's not the ideal outcome, but it's a much better outcome than extended ethnic violence. One of the things that's very interesting for those of us who study ICT is that there was an enormous amount of sort of innovation around communication during that sort of 3-month period of crisis. And I want to talk really quickly about 6 innovations and then talk about how I think it may be changing the model. So real fast, SMS became enormously important in Kenya. Mobile phones are extraordinarily widespread, very high penetration, approaching 20%. Lots and lots of SMS used, both for practical purposes, but also for incitement to violence. A lot of people essentially saying that they were getting messages saying, chase the Kikuyu from their home. And the Kikuyu were associated with the president who had just stolen power. Or, it's time to finally have it done with the Kalenjin. And thousands of these going back and forth. At a certain point, the government demanded that mobile phone operators shut down SMS. The opposition complained that actually SMS was being used in many cases to mobilize legitimate protest. So there's this really complicated question. Obviously, you don't want anyone using this to say, go kill your neighbors. On the other hand, you want to make the argument that people should be able to use this for democratic mobilization. It ended up not being shut down. Instead, there were messages sent out over the network essentially, hey, everyone, cool the hell out. And after the fact, there was an investigation that's managed to identify 1,700 people who were using SMS, sending out messages, encouraging people to commit violent acts. What's interesting is that Kenya has now looked at this and said, we can't actually find anything illegal about this. We may have to pass a law suggesting that you can't incite violence over SMS, but the way our law is currently written, we don't actually see an opportunity to prosecute these 1,700 people. So that's one thing. Second thing. Mashada.com, which advertises itself as Africa's online community, it's Kenya's online community. It's a phenomenally successful and lively and important bulletin board system for people in Kenya, and particularly in the Kenyan diaspora. It got so nasty about a week into this conflict that the administrator of the bulletin board system had to start recruiting new moderators, essentially said, I'm only going to put up moderated comments because I don't want people essentially saying, go kill your neighbors. I'm going to moderate this whole thing. His moderators started burning out so quickly. Every 48 hours, people would sort of quit and say, I just can't read this stuff anymore. About 3 weeks into the conflict, David Kobie, the guy behind this, just pulled it down and put up a new website called I Have No Tribe, urging Kenyans around the world. And it's an odd choice of the map. He doesn't actually show Kenya on the map. He sort of really focuses on the diaspora to encourage Kenyans around the world to sort of say, I have no tribe, I'm Kenyan. What was interesting was most people didn't say that. Most people actually said, well, I got a tribe. I've got a language. I'm not going to deny my people. But being Kenyan's more important than that. And this became a really interesting space to sort of reframe the debate. Rather than the complete unstructured nature of the bulletin board, this sort of put it in a bit more context. But keep in mind just the size of the diaspora community here, because that's going to get really important in a second. Third, one of the things that those of us who study citizen media are really concerned about was the extent to which blogs became newspapers during this. There was a 48-hour period during which broadcast media was not reporting live. And at that point, blogs became enormously important. One of the things that you have to understand in East Africa is that people are much more attuned to blogging than you would think. Even in countries that are sub 10% internet penetration, it's pretty common for radio hosts on morning talk shows to get up and read the blogs over the air every day. So my Kenyan friends say, look, you know, yeah, I can reach 7% of the population with my blog, unless it gets picked up by a good DJ, in which case I'm reaching 90% of the population. So blogs are mass media in a very interesting and very strange way. And these were elite media for that 7 to 10% who were able to get online for this period of time, but they were also critical media as far as keeping that moment-to-moment reportage going while a lot of journalists weren't out in the street. And what was particularly interesting in Kenya was you saw bloggers who are normally pretty sedate, behind-the-lines sort of guys getting out there with a camera. This is a blog post by a guy named Doughty Were. Doughty is a hacker. He's a computer programmer. This guy lives in front of a terminal 14 hours a day. About 5 days into the crisis, he's out with a long lens camera in the streets, in the face of the riot police, taking the photos. And everyone around the world is sort of writing to him going, dude, please be careful. You're not a journalist. You haven't done this before. But ended up doing some of the more interesting journalistic work that was out there. Great. Another one that's really interesting. Kenyan writers, particularly led by Binyawanga Wainaiwa, who wrote a gorgeous essay, which if you haven't read it, is titled How to Write About Africa. And if you've not read this essay, go online immediately. Do not pass go. Read the essay. It's one of the most angry, provocative, beautiful pieces of writing about images of Africa in Western media. These guys essentially said, part of what we got to do here is win a PR battle globally. We can't have our country viewed as a disaster area. Too much of our economy depends on tourism and depends on exports. If Kenya is viewed as the next basket case on the continent, we're dead economically. And so these guys mobilized not so much in the local media, but in the global media. And this was a group of writers, some in the country, some in the diaspora, and their targets were papers like the New York Times. And they managed to get op-eds in them, generally within 3 days of the conflict, with the common message that this isn't Rwanda, this isn't going to break down to thousands of people killing thousands of others. This is a real, legitimate political dispute. And they were quite successful in getting that message out. If you watch how the tone, particularly in American and British media, changed, there was about 24 hours of another Rwanda is coming, which very quickly, even before the violence dropped off, turned into a very different message. Okay? Two more. Mama Mike's. This is a really interesting site focused on what we call alternative remittance. Say you want to send money home to your family in Kenya. If you send cash via Western Union, there's a whole bunch of bad things that happen. The first is that Western Union takes almost 10% off the top of it, which is not great news. The second is that it shows up as cash, and so you're walking into downtown Nairobi into a store that basically says, people here are getting money. And then you're walking out with a wad of bills, and there's a couple of young men with knives who are walking down the street after you. Third of all, you've just sent money home to Uncle Mike, who happens to have a drinking problem, and may end up drinking most of the money that you sent home. So you wrap all of these things together, and one of the things that's become incredibly popular in the developing world in the last couple of years is called alternative remittance. Rather than sending $100 home, I send $100 as a voucher, which can get used as the grocery store, or can get used to buy petrol, or can get used to buy mobile phone minutes. It's not cash. In some ways, it's actually better than cash. It's much more targeted than cash. A site like Mama Mike's, which has been a pioneer in this space, ended up becoming a pioneer both in reporting, in that they were making it possible for people to buy cell phone minutes, which became pretty essential for these bloggers who were out there reporting, but also for the relief efforts. And these guys ended up doing an enormous amount of coordination and sort of handout for groups like Red Cross. Okay? Last thing I want to talk about, and then talk about this model, ushahidi.com. Anyone who's heard me talk here has probably heard me rant and rave about this site. This was a project to document violence through the eyes of citizen media. And so documenting both violence and peacemaking efforts sort of one site at a time by letting people text in a message and say, hey, so-and-so was just beat up in this neighborhood. Here's where it occurred. The guys at Ushahidi would then take that SMS or that email or that message via the web, put it on a map, show the visualization. And one of the things that was very interesting about it was that it helped show just how clustered this violence was. It helped show the geographic centrality of it. When you could get it down to the neighborhood level, it helped make this point that this was largely political and economic violence. This wasn't the sort of nationwide ethnic tension that we've seen elsewhere. What was very interesting about this from the innovation point of view was how this project came about. This idea of building a map of violence and a map of peacemaking efforts took about 4 days from inception to execution. It started out as a blog post on the blog of Oria Kola, who's a former Harvard Law student, was very involved with the Berkman Center, currently works in Johannesburg. She had been reporting events on the ground in Kenya, decided that she had to go back to Joburg in part because she had a young baby, wasn't completely safe for her to be with this very young child in Nairobi, went home. Immediately after she went home, she said, you know, I'm just worried that we're going to lose all these reports coming in of people being damaged, you know, houses being burned, shops being looted. I want to make sure we get all of it. That message got picked up by the Kenyan diaspora, and a really interesting team formed. Two people who were on the ground in Kenya, one who was in Eldoret, where a lot of the violence was taking place, one who was in Nairobi. And these two focused on sort of partnering with civil society organizations and getting their reports. A programming team got built around David Kobie, who was in Birmingham, Alabama, who was the guy behind Mashada.com, and a truly crazy guy named Eric Hirschman, who blogs as White African. He's a Kenyan-American white dude who was born outside of Nairobi, has dual citizenship. He's based in Orlando, and he ended up being the designer and the project manager on it. And these guys, as sort of a distributed team, managed to get this application up in about 4 days. This application is good enough that it has won pretty much all the social media contests that it's been in. It won NetSquared's major prize for sort of social media innovation. It's already getting adopted by other groups facing similar problems. So for instance, when South Africa started experiencing xenophobic violence within townships, a local NGO there grabbed this application and started using it. It's now being released as an open source platform. So I want to raise this idea and hope to use it a little bit as we sort of frame some of the stuff that Eric's going to talk about, and we're going to pass off the cable while we do this, which is, what do you need to innovate? The theory that I went in with years and years ago, now 99, so almost a decade ago, was the idea that you actually needed a local community that could bring all these skills to the table. And that was really based on my experience living out in Western Massachusetts and happening to be lucky enough to live next to some brilliant sysadmins, some guys who knew how to raise venture capital. We were close enough to New York that we could get ad sales guys. We could get them all there in the same building. And my theory had been that that's what Africa needed as well. You needed that set of talents in Accra, in Nairobi, in Johannesburg, in all of these different urban centers. One of the things that's emerging a bit, I think, is this idea that you could actually have a network community instead. So what ends up happening is that you can build that team, but it might be Ghanaians who are in Orlando, Florida, mm-hmm. or Birmingham, the UK, or Nigeria, getting together around a common topic. And we're seeing this in the Kenyan scene, because these guys are ludicrously well put together and well organized, but I think you're going to start seeing it around other projects as well. And guys like Eric are deeply tied into these networks on the continent that have people who aren't living in their home countries but are highly focused on their home countries. I want to add sort of one other thought about that, which is that I see this as sort of an intermediate state. My hope would be that this is sort of temporary, this is sort of part-time. What you really want to be seeing in the long term, I would hope, is people who aren't necessarily from these countries getting involved with innovation in these countries. It shouldn't have to be just Kenyans who are concerned about Kenya's recovery. It makes sense that Kenyans would be concerned about Kenya's recovery. Where we get more mature and more complete in this is once we get to the point where it's not just the Kenyans, it's people who are concerned about transparency, good governance, civil society as a whole, who are getting involved with these efforts and finding ways to sort of collaborate across cultural boundaries, rather than just sort of assuming that we're organizing the Kenyan diaspora digitally in one fashion or another. And so Eric's going to talk a little bit about two projects on the continent which have involved some really interesting border crossing. Not just people working in their own countries, but people really sort of working on a continent-wide basis. And of course, it's going to be easier for Eric to do this if we can figure out how to get his laptop up here. So if we have any Mac experts that... I've tried my two known tricks here. Maybe it's refreshing the... can we get the little tablet, please, that drives the projector? I don't think it's
probably
know that it's that.
Is it frozen?
No, it's not frozen.
Oh, it's frozen.
Oh, it is frozen.
That'll do it.
So Eric's going to reboot, and while Eric reboots, any questions, any comments, anyone want to... Objections? Observations? We can also pass around the brownies. I'd also like to point out that my colleague has brought... we were debating earlier whether it's swag or schwag. So depending on your pronunciation, one way or another, if you'd like to feel slightly more Ghanaian as you participate in this, we have bracelets, we have keychains that will allow you to embrace your inner Ghanaian. I recommend it. I've been much happier since embracing my inner Ghanaian. You should have seen me before. I was a much unhappier guy. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, well, I mean, it works. It's nice to have, you know, it's nice to have a group behind you. I was walking with Georgia Popelwell, my managing director of Global Voices, on the streets of Budapest very late at night. And a bunch of Nigerian guys pass us in the other direction and sort of stop and confront us and turn to her and say, "Sister, are you okay?" Because they're really worried that I'm, like, dragging her down into an alley or something like that. And, you know, she's not Nigerian, she's Trinidadian, but it says, "No, it's okay, brothers, I'm okay." But, yeah, so, you know, put it on, Doc, and, you know, the Ghanaian diaspora will be behind you, man. That's not a bad thing. That's what you're looking for. So we're good now.
Right? Yep, we're good. So
right. Go ahead and launch.
So this is Yusuf Indo for those who don't. He's sort of my African hero, a great musician. Managed to popularize Senegalese music, called Mbalé, which is off Wolof. Wolof is sort of a very small tribe in Senegal, and he's got very, you know, interesting music.
You gotta be loud, dude.
Okay.
This doesn't actually amplify you. That's just for the broadcast.
Okay.
People are having trouble hearing it.
Okay.
Oh, PowerPoint. That explains everything.
Yeah. Okay, so
there we go.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is try and talk about two main stories, what I call stories of innovation. One is sort of... the big mobile success story of Sertel, which is now Zain, for those of you who sort of heard the name, and the big One Network that they've been able to build, not only in Africa, but across the Middle East. And then I want to talk about how to reduce, you know, a business model that reduces in bandwidth costs from $7,000 to $5,000. I think that's really incredible, and it's going to have an impact on sort of connectivity around the continent. So the One Network story... it's about a gentleman called Mo Ibrahim. Mo Ibrahim is Sudanese, but, you know, grew up in the UK and sort of did his studies in mobile communications. Until in 1998, he decided to focus on sort of bringing connectivity to the very poor in Africa. Basically, his argument, to some extent, is indicated in Jeffrey Sachs' recent story in The Guardian, where sort of extreme poverty is about isolation. And so his idea was that how do we register very remote people, provide ways for them to be able to communicate and be able to hear from them, and also, you know, them to be part of the larger society or the global economy. So in 1998, he started a company called MSI Cellular. And essentially, there are some very significant things that happened then. In 98, there were 2 million cell phones in the continent, in the whole of Africa, and sort of about, you know, two-thirds of that were in South Africa. Now, he had a big problem sort of raising money for this venture, and sort of the big problem was with potential investors then was that, Africa, you know, does not respect contracts. So it's very difficult for us to give you money to go and set up in Africa because we don't know what will happen, you know. And, of course, the political situation in certain countries then, like Congo, were very bad, where there was, civil unrest. And so it was very high risk to take. But a gentleman basically said, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to do it by myself and sort of build a European quality network without paying a bribe. So this was two key principles by which he sort of ventured into this exercise. Now, he came up with a sort of model that Ethan has written a lot about, which is sort of incremental infrastructure. Now, you expect that if somebody wants to build a mobile network, you need about five-plus, you know, millions of dollars in order to build base stations, you know, get terminals, etc. His idea was basically to start small. So go into a country, use your own pocket money, build one base station. Get some handsets into the hands of people. Start providing very good service. And then based on, you know, your revenue, you can then scale. So the second month, you build another base station. Third month, you build another base station based on the inflows. I mean, that's very, very interesting that he was able to sort of kickstart that. And within 5 to 6 years, he had been able to build a very substantial network that expanded into 14 countries. One of the interesting things that he did in every country was to start in the capital city, which is normal. And once you have revenue coming in, then you could now begin to scale the network into the semi-urban and then into the rural areas. Now, something was very interesting that sort of evolved around alongside, which was this whole sending somebody a missed call. So, for example, if the network expanded to my village and I managed to get my grandmom a cell phone or something, what she would do is that she wanted to talk to me. She would send me a missed call. And because I knew her number, then I would call her up. And then we would have a conversation. Bottom line, I'm able to talk to her. She's able to tell me she needs to have my attention, so she's able to get my attention, we're able to talk. So she may not be able to buy a lot of minutes on her cell phone to make a lot of calls, but at least with the cell phone, I'm able to reach her, she's able to reach me. So that way you be got, okay, sure. Correct.
Well, totally different model.
Right.
Incoming calls are free, and generally
in India,
Six seconds you get away with. And so you'll see people have conversations that are just based on talking 5 seconds at a time. And it's pretty funny to watch a lot of the time.
Right. Well, so yes, you pointed out a model of innovation which works in developing countries where basically generally you don't charge people for incoming calls. And so they're able to at least signal that I need to talk to you. And so able to establish that connection. Well, not everyone. Basically, what has happened between now and then is the cost of cell phones have gone down. Today, their cell phones have been manufactured.
I don't mean the phone themselves. I mean, can anyone who has a cell phone be heard anywhere in the country?
Oh, okay, in terms of the expansion of the network, getting coverage.
Yeah.
Well, as it is now, almost every, I won't say every sort of rural part of Africa is covered, but pretty much you have 80% to 90% coverage.
A good study out of the London School of Economics about 2 years ago that did a survey in Tanzania, and it was quite a cross-section. So they were talking not only to urban populations but to very rural populations. And they asked people not whether they owned a cell phone but whether they could get access to a cell phone and make a call if they needed to. And the positive response rate on that was 97%.
Correct.
So functional coverage. In terms of if you really need it, can you get access to it, is nearing 100% in most African markets.
And the good thing about that also, you know, it emanates with the culture. If you go to a rural African village, what you find is that people share a lot. You know, people share food, people share their house, people share their cattle. So literally, if somebody had a cell phone in a village of 100 people, then 100 people are connected. We somehow also, you know, if you come to mainstream, you know, academic studies in terms of studying the extent to which you have coverage in terms of mobile connectivity, the internet, is sometimes a little bit of a problem in Africa because so one person have a cell phone, having a cell phone means 100 people are connected to it. They don't own it, but at least they can make a call or they can send a message using it, and so you could have that extensive coverage. What is also very interesting in terms of the rural connectivity now is generally what is becoming infrastructure sharing. Now, for most of the commercial operators, the business case for investing in a base station on an infrastructure in a rural area is becoming pretty much difficult. So the new sort of idea, which is part of a study we did, you know, 3 years ago for the World Bank around open access, is that you could go into a rural area and share common infrastructure. And so five operators, instead of each one of you having your base station and building your own network and having, you know, to recruit the investment or not being able to do it, you could together, you know, build out a single infrastructure and basically provision around it. Some of the equipment operators like Ericsson, et cetera, begin to adapt this. And so when operators come to them and they want to go into rural areas, they begin to adopt that. And Ericsson, in this case, actually has, you know, an investment to do that. So they, as equipment manufacturer, will start building infrastructure into those areas. So those are another very innovative way by which you're going to reach these rural communities and be able to provide connectivity. sure.
I like that.
Let's jump into that later, because one of the things that we can drill down a little bit on this is incremental infrastructure, shared infrastructure, and that stuff. But that Eric hasn't quite gotten to the punchline yet, which is the point about the $3.4 billion. So let's let him sort of jump forward on that, and then we'll jump into the weeds.
Okay, but bring it up because it's been. Now, another interesting thing that happened with Southall in late 2004 is that two capital cities, Brazzaville and Kinshasa, are divided by the Congo River, you know, just literally across from each other. And Mo Ibrahim had set up a network in both countries. And strangely, for someone to send a call from Brazzaville to Kinshasa, literally had to go to France and Belgium and then come back. And he literally said, this is ridiculous. We have to do something about it. So he fought the system and basically gave birth to what he called a one network. And essentially what it meant was that if you're a Celtel subscriber in Congo Brazzaville, you could make a connection to Kinshasa without, you know, transiting a call internationally and then sort of lowering it in, you know, back into the same country, the country next door. And so this basically is sort of one way of making sure that, again, if you had a mobile phone in Kinshasa and you bought units, you could actually use the same in the next door country. So literally the network becomes one. And so you eliminate this huge cost. In 2000, we did a study that basically estimated that, you know, routing local traffic through third parties cost Africa roughly about $500 million every year. So generally what was happening was that $500 million were leaving the continent. So this initiative really was very strong in that, you know, it made sure that people could connect seamlessly and also could save money and keep money in the continent. In April 2005, interestingly, Celtel got a lot of attraction and was bought by the NTC Group for $3.4 billion. And this was very significant. This is starting the company sort of 8 years down the line with literally no money out of your pocket and building up. Of course, I mean, at some point, Celtel attracted capital investment from African Development Bank and a couple of corporations and money to scale up. But really, it was bootstrapping a whole mobile infrastructure from your pocket. And then sort of 8 years down the line, being bought at $3.4 billion was very significant. And it wasn't just any company, but it was a world-class network that worked, you know, provided services and could reach more people and made money, was profitable business. So in some way, you are addressing a major developmental problem by literally building a business that was scalable.
This story is replicated in specifically in this industry.
Correct.
And this is one of these interesting questions, because we largely see the success story around the telecoms industry in Africa, but you can tell almost the identical story about a Gambian entrepreneur named Aliou Kanté, who started a network in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the wake of the first wave of what we tend to refer to as the African World War, the Democratic Republic of Congo War. And that's a company that literally, when he began it, he had to finance all the equipment ahead of time. One of the interesting questions in all of this, if you want to build a mobile phone network in Western Massachusetts, for instance, please come. We'd appreciate it. You'll be able to put down about 10% on the equipment, and generally speaking, the vendor will finance the rest of it for you if you have anything resembling a responsible finance record. Kanté discovered in some cases he had to put down 110% of the cost of the equipment to be able to get it. He actually had to pay significantly more because they assumed that there would be claims of theft in transit. So they actually charged him an additional 10%, wouldn't extend any credit, and he sort of managed to get it off the ground and in that sort of circumstance. So these sort of branding questions and sort of questions about whether in fact there is competition on equal footing is an interesting one. But around telecoms, and particularly around mobile telecoms, there's sort of half a dozen stories that look a whole lot like this one.
Right. So to try and sort of end that story, the one network idea became very big and sort of was the big attraction that led MTC to buy Celtel.
And so just this year, MTC then rebranded as Zane. And the most interesting thing about the whole Zane One network is that between the Middle East and Africa, if you want any of these, one on the Zane network, you can use it anywhere. So I could use my Zane number if I go to the Middle East, if I was in Africa, in 14 African countries, anywhere. I could use the same number, I could buy units, I could top up, and I didn't need to pay the extensive roaming charges in using that infrastructure. So like Ethan indicated in his presentation, you could see that the extensive build out of the mobile infrastructure has led to a lot of things. In this case, you know, sort of XMS and et cetera.
Before you go on, was all of that continuation of the old pricing model to the consumer built into the agreement between MTC when it was acquired? I mean, are they?
Correct, yes.
Okay, so yes. They agreed to this.
They agreed to that. And actually, the evidence is that was a big attraction for the MTC group. They basically wanted to also provide seamless connectivity because, I mean, there's a large interaction between the Middle East and Africa. And so their logic was that if we could have one network infrastructure, then we could be scalable and we could be the most attractive network. Again, they are the MTNs of this world on the continent that came out of South Africa. There's Globacom out of Nigeria, all trying to follow up the example of CellTel being able to build a very extensive infrastructure and then, you know, going global. And so with almost like 100 million people, you know, having mobile connectivity in Africa now, there's almost literally the talk that Africa's email is SMS. So most people, instead of sending an email, will be able to send an SMS back and forth and be able to interact. So like Ethan said, now even on radio stations in the morning, not only do they read blogs, but a minister will be put on a radio station in the morning and somebody will SMS from his house and say, the minister said he was going to fix the road next in front of my house and the road is not fixed. And the SMS we read to the minister and say, well, you said you'll fix this road. You know, so ways of bringing accountability to politicians just because someone could send an SMS. And now even the radio stations are using the same collaborative model where actually you could send a missed call to the radio station and they will phone you and then put you on the phone and then you can ask a question to anybody. And, you know, so sort of it's beginning to create very interesting way.
I'm just surprised that the acquiring company thought that this business model was the best way for them to make money.
So one of the things that you sort of have to understand in understanding this ability to have portability country to country is that one of the major economic problems on the continent historically has been extremely small states with extremely rigid borders.
Right.
Nancy Birdsall, who chairs the Center for Global Development down in D.C., one of the better global development think tanks, has a lecture that basically starts, imagine the state of Mississippi in 1940.
Right.
And now imagine that it's a sovereign nation and decides not to trade with the rest of the United States. What do you think the level of development of the state of Mississippi is going to be 50 years later? And to a large extent, that's what post-colonial Africa has sort of looked like. There's an enormous push right now from this sort of next generation of African entrepreneurs to sort of say, we've got to get beyond the nationalism associated with this. And for me, like that's the downside of that Kenya story. Is that it's just Kenyans, right? The really interesting projects are the ones that are aiming at what one thinker is now calling the Africa Twos. And what he's basically saying is the Africa Ones are the old money plutocrats, the guys driving the Mercedes, the guys that for the most part we've been trying to throw out over the last 10 or 20 years. The Africa Threes are the folks that you're all used to seeing on television. It's the people living on $2 a day and such. There's a group of Africa Twos who are young, aspirational Africans who are responsible for the rise of the mobile phone, the rise of the shopping mall, which is now almost a plague in sub-Saharan Africa, the rise of the sort of the big box store, the rise of intra-African tourism. Every time I look at buying property in Accra, I discover that I'm being outbid by Nigerians because
yes.
Accra turns out to have become the most popular vacation destination for Nigerians. If you really want to get a break from Nigeria,
yeah.
Ghana is sort of
yeah.
Nigeria turned down about four notches. So it's
actually good. Not just a break, but I have friends, Nigerian friends, who live in Accra and work in Lagos. And there's 5 daily flights between Accra and Lagos. Interestingly, it takes 45 minutes to fly from Accra to Lagos, and it takes 1 hour to fly from Lagos in the same country to Abuja, the capital.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting to see this sort of integration within this aspirational middle class. And that integration points to this incredible need for roaming, this incredible, you know, opportunity to actually build infrastructure that sort of crosses it. We don't have the railroads, we don't have the roads, we're only starting to get the air networks that can do it, but now we're starting to get mobile networks that can do it. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. When I was in Africa, now this was several years ago.
Sure.
You know, I was a tourist, and they took us on little tourist things, and one of the things they took us to is to see the Maasai, who live in little huts made of cow manure and have goats and don't have, now, is that fake? Do they really have the computers and the phones and...
Oh, yeah.
So it's basically a fake tourist thing to get some money.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, today Maasai are using phones, using computers. So, I mean, if I go to Kenya, and interesting to just complement that point, it's not just the mobile network, but somehow also the airline networks are beginning to work. For example, if you take Kenyan Airways, today Kenyan Airways have daily flights from Accra to Nairobi. So I managed to set up an office now in Nairobi and also in South Africa, and it's simply because anytime I want to fly to Nairobi, and interestingly, Ghanaians don't need a visa to go into Kenya. So I can wake up tomorrow morning and say, okay, I want to go to Kenya, and I've got a flight. I just have to be at the airport before 9 p.m. and then sleep on the flight and wake up the following morning and I'm in Nairobi. And I can go to a meeting and do all kinds of stuff, and then so the following day in the morning, go to the airport and come back to Accra. So in other words, sort of there's also development on the airline infrastructure, and that is also helping a lot with movements. And so with people being able to communicate also, that becomes very crucial to create mobility and also to create trade within Africa. And in fact, intra-African trade is very, very crucial as we go forward. Let me jump on to the next story that I wanted to say, just because I think we now are getting more questions and it's getting more interactive, is the TEAMS story. And basically, TEAMS is the East African Marine System. I think I've mentioned this before, but it's basically a fiber connectivity. Well, the background to this is that East Africa is the only part of the world that doesn't have an undersea cable. So most of the connectivity infrastructure in East Africa today goes over satellite. And that, for a 2-meg connection, costs you about $7,000. Now, the thing about TEAMS, among other cables that are supposed to be built, is that it hopes to be able to bring the cost of connectivity from $7,000 to $5,000. And it's because of the innovative business model.
Cost of connectivity for a dedicated...
2-meg connection.
Okay.
So let me jump to this very quickly. I mean, it's basically the business model, right? The business model looks at a high volume, low margin approach. And to some extent, this also answers your question about the one network model, which is generally that you want to have a network that has a high volume of traffic, because you've invested in all this infrastructure. And if it's so expensive for people to use, you end up having so much redundancy at the network. But if you can, if the margin is very low in terms of connectivity and people just being able to have access, then over a period of time, you could actually make a lot more money in the long term. Because, you know, high volume traffic basically just means a lot of people be able to talk, and so you may be able to have a higher turnout on the infrastructure. So that's one thing to look at. So the TEAMS model generally looks at a public-private partnership where essentially you allow public funds to minimize the private risk. So the government of Kenya, for example, owns 20% of the cable and is basically insisting that it should be $500 per meg. And the general idea is that it's putting down most of the money that now allows private investors like my company, which owns 3% of the cable, to be able to bring in private money and be able to, together with 12 other Kenyan companies. And it's interesting, if you look at the whole TEAMS model, most of the investors are within East Africa. Most of the telecom companies that are able to make money and then reinvest in building the cable. So earlier on, I was just starting with Ethan, and basically we were discovering that it's interesting that Kenya just, and all this happened right before the election, through the election period to now. I mean, I went to Kenya. Well, we've been working on the cable for almost a year, but the height of it was just the period before the elections. We struck the deal. We got Alcatel-Lucent to agree to build the cable. And most of the financing and the structuring was done during the period of the election. And I actually remember that, you know, even on 25th day of December, I had a call from the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Communication, you know, trying to have a sort of some more discussion about finalizing documents, structuring things, and moving it forward, talking to Alcatel. On the day of the elections, we were still working. Post-election, when there was violence and all this was going on, we were still busy sort of stretching this cable sending the investor memo out, getting people expressing interest, meeting like this, and sort of finalizing the CMA agreement. And this was all in the height of sort of this whole election thing happening. We somehow, for me, the big thing that I got out of it was that you had the Kenyan economy being resilient enough to continue in certain ways despite the election outcome. And it wasn't just, sort of those of us in the IT sector. I mean, if you look at other parts of the economy, for example, the transport network was working, except in cases where in the place that there were violence, you had some of these people interrupting the flow of traffic. And so the police had to go there. So you had a very resilient system in place that was able to make sure that something like this happened under such condition. The most interesting thing to take home from this is that the Teams cable is going to have a tremendous impact. Just imagine that today people pay $7,000 for a 2-meg connection to get to the internet, and you have such interesting innovation like Ethan showed, and then sort of a year from now, people are going to pay $500 to get onto the internet. There's going to be a massive uptake of connectivity. And not only is this going to happen, using the mobile infrastructure, of course, mobile phone is becoming the main way by connecting to the internet, but also with Negro Porting's $100 laptop and all these cheap laptops coming up now. You can get laptops for, $200, $300. I bought on my last year, I bought the EPC for $400 because I wanted it with a webcam. And it's been very good for us to use in the office. So with all this coming up, you could then see a very huge culture of innovation. I wanted to end on a note of the story that was written recently in the New York Times by Greg Zachary about being in Nairobi. So on my last trip here, I was in Palo Alto, and then he and I had a bit of a strong debate. I was saying, look, this stuff happened in Kenya. It wasn't as bad as the Western media reports it. Why don't you get on a plane and go down there? So he basically, in his story, I had it open, but, because I restarted my computer. But generally, he saw a young guy who was actually writing a program that will work on Apple's iPhone without even seeing the iPhone. He was basically writing the program based on using a simulator. So basically what this means is that very quickly you could have a young African brain developing software that, could go global. I mean, he could be get bought by Apple or wherever it is, and then you have another story of Mo Ibrahim right over there. The innovation around providing cheaper connectivity and bringing communication to a pervasive culture is very interesting. For me, I think it's very inclusive, and to some extent, I agree very much with the recent story by Jeffrey Sachs that probably the digital divide is closing. I mean, there's been a lot of very, critical comments about Sachs' sort of rendition, but I see him talking more of sort of what is possible and the things that will happen based on the fact that people have been exposed to digital technology. And I think that sort of going forward, that's going to be a major part of the economic development in Africa. So I think I will leave it at that and probably will jump into anything.
Let me say a couple of things. One is that officially our lunches are an hour and we're through with that hour. And if anyone feels like walking out, our feelings won't be hurt. I also would like to applaud us on achieving sort of a West African atmospheric temperature in this room. So for anyone who's nodding off and needs to go elsewhere, feel free to step out. But I think we'll happily take about 25 minutes of questions on this, but I'm going to reserve the right to ask the first one, which is kind of a pointed one, which is, so you're involved with the Teams cable. Mm-hmm. The Teams cable is one of five different cables that people are trying to build down the east coast of Africa. This is a slam dunk investment for someone, right? These are small but rapidly growing economies. They have demonstrated telecommunications and data needs. We've seen success as far as mobile phones go. But your experience and my experience with this is that there is not international money flooding into these projects. And you're sort of celebrating state money in this as sort of a way of reducing risk on this. To me, I see that and I panic, dude. I'm like looking at that and going, that's still a problem.
Correct.
That we have to have the government of Kenya stand up and say, we believe this is going to happen, we're going to put the money on the table. The thing that everyone fears in African economies is nationalization, right? I mean, what people are now sort of staring down in Zim is the possibility that the government is going to take any business that continues to survive and sort of bring it in-house and find a way to sort of prop up that state a little bit longer. What do we need to do to get to the point where Africa becomes a space for venture capital instead of adventure capital, which is sort of where we are right now?
Well, this you see more as an interim measure. And of course, in the specific case of what at the time that this needed to happen, I think this was a very good way of the politician saying that I'm putting my money where my mouth is, which generally has not been the case with most politicians. But in the long term, I agree with you that we need to have a case where you have pure private money being able to fund this. But in the interim, I mean, there's huge political risk in sort of stepping forward to doing, this is a $160 million project. For me, it's more of an interim measure that will prove that this can work and therefore will make it easy for the other for the long-term investment to come on board. For example, if you take the other cable, there's another one called Seacom being built along the same path. Seacom is being built purely with private money. And basically, Seacom piggybacks on Teams because it says, well, I mean, if all this can happen and there's a lot of pent-up demand, then we can build a second cable that competes, and it's purely having private investment. So somehow, I mean, I take your point that in the long term we need pure private money, but I think in this case you have a public money minimizing the risk and providing the space for private investors to be able to come in and take over. Now, the thing with the Teams model is that it's not going to be run by the government. The government is just a shareholder. It's a pure private corporation that is going to own the infrastructure. And actually, it's not going to provide services. It's not going to compete with the service provider. It's going to be an infrastructure provider that provides bandwidth connectivity. So all the service providers, including my company and other company, have open access, equal access. So you go in, I want 2 meg from here to Malindi, and then there you go. They provision it for you. I want connectivity from Kenya to Rwanda, at 5 meg, there you go, it's over there. So I think this is an innovative way of sort of overcoming a problem. But in the long term, I agree that, you know, you need pure private investment to make this.
Yes, Oliver?
Well, I'm very glad to hear these presentations. It's very exciting. One of the reasons it's exciting to me is it ties into a project that I'm helping to work on, which is the Law Lab project here at Berkman. And one of our goals in this is really to see how to develop more easily deployable structures for private economic activity. And in a sense, how to solve exactly the kinds of reliability of institutional framework problems that you're identifying, and how to use methods that might, how to use the web as a means of delivering some of those, as well as being the product itself. It can also be help to deliver formats for investment structures, cooperation structures more generally, private economic structures through the web itself. And so I'd love the chance to, I plant that seed that is something to think about and something we're working on, and then also hopefully something, a conversation we can have further would be very interesting to do.
I think where you're right on is that for the sort of next generation of development, which needs not just to be nation-by-nation development, but actually needs to be sort of infrastructural development, which actually crosses a lot of national borders, there's a need for new organizational structure. You guys have, what, a Ghanaian-Kenyan-Tanzanian partnership associated with UAE as well as...
ECOWAS.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the sort of structures that are coming into play are pretty phenomenally complicated. And we're getting into really esoteric corners of international corporate law. And sort of having pre-built structures of one fashion or another that people could sort of say, okay, we want to build a partnership involving people in these four countries and to do a project that's actually spanning between them and have some sort of ready-made organizational structure that's going to be legally binding in all of those venues and capable of working within it would actually be a huge step forward.
The highest and most complicated level. The other thing we're quite frankly very interested in is how does this become a tool of reliable contracting? How does, because if this is the means of communication, this is already the means of payment, this is already the means of settlement, can it also become the means by which people can then create contracts, have some kind of enforcement mechanism through this thing itself, so that it's not just a buy-sell or a communication, but the communication becomes the way of law, in which case it becomes really not just the international thing, but also the small claims court.
Right.
And well, once it becomes that, then you unleash a whole different set of possible transactional.
I see that happening. Just last week, there was a story in Tanzania where a court admitted text message as evidence in a court case. The long-term side of that is that we need to build a legal regime to ensure that digital evidence can be admitted as.
The software, the ability to call on an execution, on reliable execution through this, then you don't need...
You do need the legal structure, as we were seeing within Kenya, where you suddenly have the circumstance of trying to figure out whether you prosecute someone or not for incitement to violence over SMS, and you discover that it's simply never been considered under case law, and therefore the government finds itself... looking at 1,700 potentially very bad actors and not able to act on it. So I
think, but I also suggest that it's worth thinking about how this makes it possible to end run a bunch of what was otherwise going on just by building it into the code. If I have reliable execution through a company that stands in the way of reliability, it becomes like a bank under a letter of credit. The letter of credit system with banking is independent of the legal enforceability because of their reliability.
But the fear at this point, right? So we've got a lot of systems that are developing around the mobile. And the fear within this is that you have mobile phone companies becoming, in many cases, the dominant economic partner within an environment, right? So you've got a mobile phone company in Kenya, which is an enormously potent political force at this point.
Right.
It's also become an enormously potent economic force because now it's essentially the bank for most of the poor through the M-Pesa system. If that also becomes your contract enforcement mechanism, I mean, at a certain point, Oliver, I get real worried about where that crossover happens.
Right.
And I think I'm not necessarily, I mean, sure, I'm confident of the ability for digital signature to ensure that money makes it from my phone to your phone, but I'm a lot less confident about my ability to contract with Eric to finish a design on a website, and if he doesn't finish it out, how does that get litigated, or how does that get mediated?
I won't do away with it completely, but it would, if it becomes as reliable as something like this, then this in developed countries serves that function. You can go into all kinds of places, use this, and essentially have, you know, that they will be your litigation forum if you dispute the purchase. And my point is, I think that as you get various ways utilizing the digital platforms, whether it's this or whatever, that make the kinds of business structuring that is the impediment, at least frequently, to entrepreneurship and innovation, made accessible through means like this, then a bunch of things will be possible that would be impossible.
Emmanuel said it's had
a problem.
I mean, I agree 100% because it's talking about functionality and easy access. I understand that technically. I think the two issues that come out of this, pull up to your whole analysis, is the whole aspect of governance and compliance. You got governance and there's accountability. So there's not ultimately one person or a group of people having so much power and autonomy, there's no accountability. The other thing is, of course, functionality. So I think my question to pull up this is this, you know, I've done a lot of work in Kenya, like you've seen, I like the idea of the Western Union story. The problem, obviously, is really, I'm very interested in how Ibrahim got away with corruption. We tried a lot in Kenya. I mean, you know the difficulty there. Even people pass this, you know,
right.
And they still can't trust people. So the challenge is really, in Africa, you have the collaboration. The problem is creating trust outside of Africa because of corruption and so much money leaving Africa. How do we establish accountability and credibility? How do you trust each other? Because, you know, as you go to Ghana and Kenya, and times, there are different cultures, even slightly between tribes. So how do you trust each other that 10 years from now, not just nationally, but actually you have some corruption within the structure so that you can't even trust your own partnerships because the money grows. And you know, as money grows, you're going to get a lot of legal issues. So how are you going to, First, I want to know, how did Ibrahim get 110% without corruption and bribery? And again, how do you eradicate potential future 10 years from now? This whole, I don't know if people have actually anticipated what it's going to look like. So, do you have any idea of what you think?
Well, but on the corruption issues, I think that is basically taking a stand and basically standing by your principles and saying that this is how we're going to do it. I think in Ibrahim's case, one thing that was very phenomenal in those days was just the idea of introducing mobile phone to people and to politicians was very interesting. For example, if you told the president, look, I can give you a phone that you can figure out what your ministers are doing on the field, he may be less interested in asking for a bribe. So somehow the pioneering role, of course, it has its own challenges in other ways, but I think predominantly it's just sticking by the principles and basically saying this is how we want to do it and this is how it must be done. You want to take the second question?
Well, let me tell a quick story about corruption. I moved to Ghana for the first time in 1993, and I went over with a group of U.S. Fulbright students who were going over to study over there. And we'd had all the briefings, and we'd been told, you know, West Africa is a shockingly corrupt place. You may have to pay bribes to do things, so on and so forth. One of the guys in my group goes into Kotoka Airport in Accra, and he's got $25 bills because he assumes that he's going to need to pay bribes to get out of the airport. And so the first guy who's anywhere near him, who's just trying to take his bag, gets a U.S. $5 bill. And so, unsurprisingly, a large line of people assemble in front of this guy to make sure that he does not make it through the airport with any of his $5 bills intact. And he comes through Kotoka thinking, oh my God, this is the most shockingly corrupt country I've ever seen in my life. And the rest of us go through and go, oh man, you're not making it 3 months in this country. Yep. And one of the things that happens with corruption is we tend to refer to it as an African problem. It's not an African problem. It's a perceptual problem that affects Africa and everyone who's encountering Africa. When you see efforts like Publish What You Pay that essentially are trying to get Western companies to take responsibility for documenting whether they're putting payments on the table and basically admit to their role in corruption, it actually levels the playing field a little bit on this. One of the things that's becoming increasingly clear to most governments on the continent is that corruption has become problematic and endemic and has been a major force holding things back. And most of the sort of progressive governments where you would try to start a business nowadays are not going to be in your face about sort of looking for the money for it. Now, there's other levels to this, right? I don't know the whole story on Ibrahim, but I know Kante's story pretty well in DRC. Yeah. And a couple of things that sort of come into play there. One is that one of the reasons that Elia Kante did so well was that he bet on the right side. You know, he bet on Kabila. And he bet that Kabila was going to be able to come in and take over that country. And he bet that he was eventually going to be able to secure it. And he bet right. And if he'd bet wrong, we probably wouldn't be talking about him. We'd be talking about that poor guy from the Gambia who was a good coffee importer in South Africa but had no business getting into the DRC. The second thing that happened was not corruption, but it is a question of sort of shifting business fields, which is when he first went in to buy a GSM license, it cost $2 million. By the time he actually managed to get the license from the government, the price had been jacked up to about $6 million, and the government was asking $10. Is that corruption? It's interesting. What happened was the government literally didn't know what the license was worth. And as they realized that this guy would take $2 million out of his pocket, they said, well, how about four? When it was clear that he would pay four, the question, how about 10? And then they sort of settled on six. But, you know, those of us who've negotiated with governments, this isn't necessarily malice. In a lot of cases, this is just gross inexperience. If you've never structured that deal before, and you don't know to sort of lean on your neighbors and sort of ask the question, hey, what did you pay for your license, or you don't lean on international expertise to sort of find out what are the going rates around this. There's an entire and very strange economy basically made out of U.S. PhDs who do nothing but sort of get on planes and advise African governments. Mm-hmm. And you can knock it all you want, but it's real useful when it comes down to a government being able to make that intelligent counter offer to Conte rather than essentially picking those numbers out of the air. So I hear you, but I also want to push back against it a little bit. I mean, the question that I sort of want to put on the table here is basically, what does it take to get the next order of magnitude of success story here? The success stories that Eric's showing are ones that are such slam dunks that you would have to be an idiot not to invest in a mobile phone company that's growing at 40% a year and is turning over cash at 30% year to year. It's absolutely obvious, and it's still hard to get people to invest in that. We now look at something like the Teams cable, which to me looks absolutely dead obvious. I've been trying to work with Eric and look for U.S. investors on this, and I go and talk to hard-headed U.S. investors who will happily throw millions of dollars at the latest Facebook clone. And as soon as you tell them that the partnership is based in Kenya, they sort of go, that's a little risky for me, and back off. And so there's a perceptual issue here that we have to deal with. It isn't just about the economics here. At a certain point, this comes to cultural barriers and, let's be frank about it, racism, that make it very, very difficult to sort of gain investment and do business in these parts of the world.
Let me give you one little story about our team's involvement. You know, my company is a pretty small company compared to the other telecom companies that were involved in this. And there was some effort to try and kick us out, you know. And the permanent secretary of the ministry basically literally said, no, these guys have met the criteria. They've been part of the project. And literally, we did some work. We designed the team's model on a pro bono basis, etc. But we really met the criteria that was set out in the investor memo. So these companies, you know, when the thing was getting hit, I went to the media. They thought he must be, the permanent secretary must have something to do with this guy. This is me and my Kenyan partner. So on and on, that anti-corruption commission got involved in it. They went to the race of companies, and they later found out, they interviewed that, they found he has nothing to do with us. And he basically worked on record saying, these guys are a small company, but they meet the record. They've been dedicated to this project. So I'm willing to support them. I'm not a director in your company. I don't have any money from them. But generally, I just think that we need to encourage SMEs to grow and be part of such big projects. So there are these examples as well, which are well, you know, putting out there.
Bruce? Certainly in Ghana, and actually for
most African countries,
most of sub-Saharan Africa, there is a deep, deep, deep bond between Lebanon and sub-Saharan Africa.
Huge.
The first sort of country to manage to have sustained overseas presence in a lot of sub-Saharan African nations were the Lebanese. You hang out in any African city, and if you're looking for a drink, frankly, on a Saturday night, ask the taxi driver where the Lebanese club is. You'll generally have a good time. So there's a very deep cultural bond, which is part of this. I think part of it is that historically there's a very blurry line between the Middle East, North Africa, and sub-Saharan Africa. We argue constantly about this within Global Voices. We basically strike a line across the Sahara, and some people actually get very upset about this and wonder, you know, whether it makes sense that Sudan should be part of the Arab world and Middle East, North Africa, and so on and so forth. I also think part of it is a willingness to deal with economies and legal systems that are somewhat murkier than you might be used to. And so that ability to do business in a system where personal ties do matter a great deal, and the possibility of, you know, Eric having a personal connection and then sort of a deal being wired in that way is something that you have to be very, very aware of. I think there are certain sensitivities about working in those economies where that it translates very well culturally from one to another. I've been surprised at how little traction a lot of the sort of Southeast Asian companies have had going into Africa. One of the debates that we have all the time is about the role of China in Africa. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people are now sort of starting to talk a lot about is cultural barrier between the two. Sure. A lot of Chinese companies have sort of come in. a lot of Africans have responded to this and sort of go, we're going to take these guys for all they're worth. Yeah. And we're now sort of like 3 to 5 years into this encounter, and there's starting to be some really ferocious standoffs. You look at something like Zambia, where, you know, a guy managed to, very close to getting himself elected on essentially an anti-China platform. There are countries that have sort of built up these relations over a much longer time, and they seem to have much more traction working in sub-Saharan Africa.
In regards to corruption, my perception, I can say, from Ghana, I would be more concerned about Western companies taking advantage of the Ghanaian markets than to see the corruption. When you're coming from outside to Ghana, for example, you're going to get more respect automatically. Assuming people assume that you must know what you're doing, you must have more money, even if you really don't, and all this. So they automatically have leverage over the local investor. So you're the one actually at an advantage. And let's say if you know something more about the market than they do, they're the ones exploiting, for lack of a better word,
right,
those markets and doing better. So the corruption, I think, is really interesting because it's for the average person in Ghana. They're the ones who have to worry about paying the guy at the door, the guy sitting behind the door. But if you're coming with millions of dollars and you're going for a big, you know, a macro project, you're not the one worrying about corruption. You're most likely also, if you're talking about race, look, you know, being white, for example, probably going to the head of the line because they're assumed you're obviously a foreigner. You know, you may be coming with serious money. So it's actually ironic that people here are worrying so much about corruption. It's really the people intra the state that have more to worry about than those coming outside.
Today's a birthday, by the way. So
happy birthday! Make sure that woman gets a cookie.
You heard him say it.
She's on a low carb diet.
We have rules here.
We had an experience in Kenya where I felt like it was my white face that got us into or out of a situation, as you might say. And I felt uncomfortable about that because I felt, why should I have that advantage?
It can be very complicated. I'm looking across the room at an old friend of mine who managed to have an incredibly salubrious effect in Ghana based on the fact that by being visibly non-Ghanaian, she was not an interested party in the establishment of the Ghanaian Internet Exchange Point. I don't know if you want to talk at all about sort of the situations in which being an outsider like lets you be a neutral mediator, Jess. But I'm definitely talking about her. So you can jump in, Emmanuel, if you like, but she's the one who...
Well, there were moments where I felt as though actually being a redhead was more noteworthy than being white. I was so alien that it worked.
Right.
There were a couple of meetings where I was a little afraid of arrest, but I think that the project that I worked on was the Ghanaian Internet Exchange Point. And it basically meant working with the CEOs, the CTOs of almost all of the network operators in the greater Accra area, which numbered 20 plus. And I was in a strange situation where I was bringing them into meetings and asking them to trust one another. We were talking about trust, we're talking about corruption, asking them to trust one another to build this thing that we were calling this national resource. The Internet Exchange Point wasn't meant to benefit any one of them, but if they all could come together, it could benefit all of them overnight, incredibly. It's one of these no-brainer projects. It makes everybody feel good and feel sort of national pride or regional pride. You start to stick them all together. So it was pretty amazing, but I found myself in some really unusual situations. I didn't actually feel as though the white thing worked all that well. We got some equipment donated from the U.S., and we had to pay to get it out. It was free equipment that we had to buy from the Ghanaian folks who received it. So that didn't work out so well. But that was sort of understood that this is how you do business. That was a piece of business. It was less about who came to pick it up and what color they were. But I actually think that because I was so different, I couldn't possibly represent the interests of any one of those companies, any one of those CEOs. It made it a lot easier to trust me and to give me the accountability for the group to try to establish agreements among them. And we had these incredible meetings where people would just, you know, walk out applauding each other and patting each other on the back, and I'm, I don't know what's going on here. Glad to be near it, but I'm not sure why it's happening. It was pretty extraordinary. I don't know, Ethan, if you have some ideas of why it happened, but I think it, I sort of fell into something that had already been happening, and I came at a lucky time, because those guys have been working for years. Eric, you were working with them for years before I showed up. Luckily, when I showed up, here was this, you know, very green project manager who was interested in just pushing the project forward, and everybody on the project was saying, we just need to do this.
I think what was interesting for me, and maybe this sort of is a good place to sum up, because we are going to stop it too, there's a lot of innovation situations in Africa where what you're looking for is a seed crystal. You're looking for some sort of catalyst, some sort of opportunity for something to gel. So just an example on this, right? I mean, we've been talking about the need for an East African cable for years and years and years. And suddenly Easy gets to the point where it looks like it's actually going to get funded, and now we've got 5 East African cables, right? You know, someone sort of demonstrates that this might actually be possible, and then there's sort of a push to the finish line on it. Yeah, absolutely. You were in a situation where you had already a developing ISP situation. You had enormous ongoing tension between all of these guys. You'd had ISPs proved on other parts of the continent, you know, but a piece of the equation that sort of helped it come in there. What I think is so challenging for those of us who are sort of invested in innovation in Africa in the long term is that we keep waiting for there to be that one missing piece, right? And again, I started my talk talking about being really stupid. And, you know, the last time I sort of looked at this in a serious way, I was sort of convinced that one missing piece was a technical skills piece. And I think what everyone who worked on those projects discovered was, yeah, it's one of about 10 missing pieces. And it's not that every project needs all 10 pieces. It's that a lot of these different situations demand one or another different missing piece. Sometimes it's a way to address trust issues. A lot of the times, guys, it's capital. And that is probably still continues to be the most difficult missing piece out of all of it. Mm-hmm. I think in Kenya, what happened was sort of a crystallization of this innovation economy that already existed, but suddenly a crisis caused a bunch of these situations to crystallize. And so, you know, the question there is, what can you learn from sort of a crisis situation and sort of take into opportunity situations? But let's break up. We can continue taking questions. Eric and I aren't going anywhere, but thank you, everyone, for coming. We really appreciate your attention and participation.
It's a good one.
It's always fun, though. It's always fun.